for the heroes of Flight 93 and for the people who loved and honored them. They didn't need to be subjected to his indecent bile. Surely, I thought, this cannot be who we are. Every year after the memorial service, Joe made it a point to stop at the Shanksville Volunteer Fire Department, where a cross made from the salvaged remains of the crashed plane stands outside the firehouse. That department was the first responder to the crash. Inside, the volunteer firefighters and their families milled about or sat at tables. Many wore MAGA hats and Trump t-shirts. Some refused to shake my hand. Others offered me their backs. I had a lot of mixed feelings about being there. It was a solemn occasion, and I didn't want to intrude at such a moment upon people who saw me through the lens of Fox and right-wing media. I knew I would never get their vote, but I didn't want to write off the opportunity to connect with a fellow American. If there was any way I could reach across the divide and share a human moment. Sometimes, as my motorcade moved through streets lined with supporters, I'd look out the window and see the one or two scowling people, arms outstretched, middle fingers raised. It pained me, especially if they had children standing alongside. There are many good reasons that the Secret Service would have objected had I stopped the motorcade to speak with them, but I often wanted to. I wished I could ask every one of them, what are you angry about? What about me makes you angry? Is it your health care, your grocery bills, a back-breaking job that doesn't pay what you're worth? And what can I do to help you? An impossible wish, since I didn't even control the lock on my car door. And there were always people waiting for me, sometimes for hours, at the next destination. One woman at the firehouse was willing to make eye contact and exchange a greeting, even though it was clear that her husband wanted nothing to do with me. I kept the conversation going, and I learned that the couple had suffered the loss of their child. There is no blue or red, no Democrat or Republican in the experience of grief and bereavement. They spoke tenderly of their child, and I shared my own experience of loss, watching my mother undone by the ravages of cancer. That brief interaction is the kind of moment that sustains my belief that we share more than we realize. We just have to be willing to look for it and see it. And then I glanced across to the far side of the room where Joe was sharing a joke with some guys in MAGA hats. One of them took his hat off and offered it to Joe. "Don't take it," I thought. He took it. "Don't put it on." He put it on. Cameras clicked. Within hours, the picture was all over. Joe Biden in a MAGA hat with the caption, "Biden endorses Trump over Harris." I took the microphone that was offered to me and said, "We may vote for different people, but the people who attacked us on 9/11 couldn't care less who we voted for. We were all Americans that day, as we are today, and I hope we can remember that." September 12th, 54 days to the election. I was back on the swing state trail the next day with an event in Charlotte. People in the audience shouted, "Concepts!" And I knew they were referring to one of Trump's low moments in the debate. Moderators asked if he had a plan to replace the Affordable Care Act, which he tried and failed to destroy in his first term. It had been saved thanks to the vote of the late Senator John McCain. "I have concepts of a plan," Trump had said. 45 million Americans are insured under the ACA, and he wants to destroy it. For concepts of a plan? I told the rally we owed it to the voters to have another debate, because this election and what's at stake could not be more important. Our campaign had raised $47 million in the 24 hours that followed it. Trump, meanwhile, was running hard in the opposite direction, telling a rally in Tucson that he was done debating. And on his social media platform, even more emphatically, "There will be no third debate," in all caps. David Plouffe answered with a post of his own. At long last, we discover his spirit animal, the chicken. September 13th, 53 days to the election. Laura Loomer had traveled on Trump's plane to the debate, to the 9/11 memorials, and to his rallies. It was clear that her special brand of vile crazy was getting in his head. She'd suggested on social media that the earrings I'd worn on the debate stage were really earpieces through which I was being fed answers. Trump parroted that line in his next speech. I learned later that the sales of those Tiffany pearl and gold earrings I'd worn and of an earpiece that looked similar had both skyrocketed. I had to laugh. Some of Loomer's racist bile was too much even for other extremists. Marjorie Taylor Greene, who'd blamed the California wildfires on Jewish space lasers, took exception to Loomer's post that if I was elected, the White House, quote, will smell like curry and White House speeches will be facilitated via a call center. If you can offend Marjorie Taylor Greene, you're really at the deep end of the hate pool. September 14th, 52 days to the election. They had to close the city hall in Springfield, evacuate schools, and lock down hospitals because of Trump's unfounded slander of the Ohio town's Haitian population. Trump's baseless debate claims that Haitians were eating pets provoked a wave of bomb threats, even after the woman who started the rumor told a Wall Street Journal reporter that her cat had been found safe in her basement and that she had apologized to her Haitian neighbors. Another woman who had amplified the rumor on Facebook also apologized, saying she'd never had any evidence for her post. None of that stopped Trump. His anti-immigrant rhetoric became even more intense in the days that followed. He appeared to revel in the chaos he could provoke. It reinforced my belief that it was a cunning strategy to distract from the fact that he had no plan to make things better for the American family. September 15th, 51 days to the election. I was home at the vice president's residence prepping remarks for a speech I planned to give on a subject of vital importance to me, the broken state of child care in the United States. Too few places available for families, a labor-intensive profession with poverty-level pay, and razor-thin profit margins for the small business owner. In short, a national disgrace and an issue where we lagged most wealthy nations. Our Build Back Better agenda had been designed to address this, but had run up against a recalcitrant Republican Congress who, for all their talk of family values, refused to see either the social or the economic upside of fixing the problem. Coming into office at the height of the pandemic, one of the first things I did as vice president was call attention to the national emergency of women exiting the workforce en masse. Were women free to participate in the labor force at the same level as men, our national GDP would be 5% higher. Quality affordable childcare, including universal pre-K, would massively improve both worker productivity and children's educational outcomes. I was working on my remarks when staff called with the news of another attempt on Trump's life. My initial reaction, how could this keep happening? I was relieved he was okay. I've had a protective detail since I became San Francisco District Attorney. I have adapted to a life in which every move I make outside of my own home must be coordinated with my protection detail. Death threats against me have been innumerable. I never talk about the threats or the people who have been prosecuted. Some elected officials speak of these things. I never have. I'm not going to be, oh, woe is me. I never carry myself in a way that I feel vulnerable or act vulnerable. But I am acutely aware of it. When you have been in the public eye as long as I have, People have long memories for things I have done that they didn't like and may have stewed over for years. I got some disapproval for saying that if somebody breaks into my house, they'll get shot. But it's the truth. I've never made a big deal of being a gun owner, but I have a reason to have a handgun. I store it securely, and I know how to use it. Staff briefed me on what little was known of the attack. Trump had set out for an unscheduled Sunday afternoon golf game at his West Palm Beach golf course. He was on the fifth fairway just after 1:30 p.m. when a member of his Secret Service detail saw the muzzle of a semi-automatic rifle pointing through the bushes at the very next hole. The agent opened fire. The would-be shooter fled. Trump, thankfully, had been whisked to safety. Very soon after, we learned to our relief that the man had been apprehended. Trump was quick to blame our campaign rhetoric for calling him out as a threat to democracy. He should have been blaming the lax gun laws he championed, since the arrested man, who had a criminal record, had been flagged by the FBI as being illegally in possession of weapons, including a fully automatic machine gun. Despite numerous convictions, he'd obviously had no trouble obtaining a lethal weapon. That night, Elon Musk posted his reckless tweet, musing as to why no one had tried to shoot me or Joe Biden. September 16th, 50 days to the election. I walked into the International Brotherhood of Teamsters roundtable in Washington, D.C., knowing I wasn't going to receive its endorsement. Most major unions already had endorsed me, including the AFL-CIO, the United Steelworkers, and the United Auto Workers. But the 1.3 million member Teamsters had yet to decide. When Biden was still in the race, we'd learned that the union was leaning toward remaining neutral for the first time since 1996. Members were angry that Biden had signed a bill blocking a nationwide rail strike that would have devastated the economy and cost thousands of workers their paychecks. I knew very well that my candidacy wasn't likely to swing the needle in our favor, despite my lifelong support for the union cause. Sean O'Brien, the union president, had spoken at the Republican National Convention. He'd asked for a speaking slot at ours as well. But why would I put someone on my stage who hadn't supported me? I'm not about to be punked. If you're flirting with my opponent, have at it. I walked in there determined to speak the truth. I was not going to let them do what they were about to do without giving them a jolt to their conscience. I would make them weigh in their own hearts and minds the decision they were going to announce. I laid out chapter and verse what unions would get from a Trump administration. I went down the list of Donald Trump's anti-union actions, and it's a very long list. From the beginning of his real estate career, screwing over workers and busting unions, to his recent conversation with Elon Musk where he said it was okay to fire workers exercising their legal right to strike. I contrasted this with the equally long list of pro-labor stands that had marked my entire career. You know what I have done. You know who is going to be better for labor. If your endorsement is based on that, it is obvious you should endorse me. I paused and looked directly at those longtime union guys. Regardless of whether you do or not, I will still be a president for all your members. I knew I had significant support in the rank and file of the union and even some support in that room. And while the General Executive Board of the Teamsters elected to make no endorsement, many Teamsters locals wound up endorsing me. Before I left, I shook every hand. From the look in their eyes, I could see that the majority knew exactly what I was saying. I'd spoken the truth, and they'd heard it. September 17th, 49 days to the election. I'd flown to Philadelphia to be interviewed by the National Association of Black Journalists. They pressed me hard, especially on the Gaza issue. I was explicit about our goals: that there be no reoccupation of Gaza, that there be no changing of the territorial lines in Gaza, that there be an ability to have security in the region for all concerned in a way that creates stability. We need to get this deal done, and we need to get it done immediately, and that is my position, and that is my policy, I said. The day before, I had asked Sheila to call Donald Trump's chief of staff to set up a call. He and I had barely spoken since we'd left the debate stage, except for the briefest of exchanges on 9/11. But there are certain things that transcend politics. We are two human beings, both parents, both with family members who worry about us. And there are very few people who know what it is like to be in the position we were in. I was backstage at the WHYY studios in Philly when it was the time agreed for the call. When we connected, his people said he'd be just one more moment. In the background, I heard him on another call. I couldn't believe they hadn't put me on mute. I could hear him flacking his new book. It sold out at Barnes & Noble and just about everywhere. Go out and get it. I hope you're going to buy the book, he said. When he finally got on the line with me, I said I was calling to check how he was. Well, I'm okay, and I hope it never happens to you. It's not a good feeling, he said. I can only imagine for you, for your family. I'm so relieved you're safe, but I'm sorry you had to go through this. It's actually quite unbelievable that in our country this would happen. I pray for your safety, I told him. He stressed how much he appreciated the call and stood up for, quote, your Secret Service, they did a fantastic job, despite the criticism he was hearing on television. He mused, quote, we're all in this very precarious position being president or vice president. It's dangerous, worse than race car drivers and bull riders. Then he started to get surprisingly effusive. It's very nice that you called, and I appreciate it. You've done a great job, you really have. You've done a very, very good job. My only problem is it makes it very hard for me to be angry at you. It's like, what am I going to do? How do I say bad things about you now? Well, then don't, I said, laughing. Then he said, I'm going to tone it down, I will. You're going to see. I said I hate to speak to her because I can't be vicious. I noted that it was important for us to be civil, especially at a moment like this. As I was wrapping up the call, he suddenly declared, my daughter, you know, is your big fan, okay? And then after a few fulsome sentences about Ivanka's regard for me, he started gushing about Doug. And say hello to your husband. He looks like a really good guy. He did a good job at the convention, by the way. I watched his speech. He really was good. He was being amiable. This man, who had called me dumb, lazy, crazy, and mentally impaired, implied that I drank and took drugs, said I was a Marxist, a fascist. People had told me that he had the capacity one-on-one to show a warmer side, that he could even be charming. I hadn't believed it, but now I was experiencing it. And then a reality check. He's a con man. He's really good at it. Jason Carter, eulogizing his grandfather, observed that Jimmy Carter was the same person no matter who he was with or where he was. And for me, that's the definition of integrity, Jason said. Trump epitomized the exact opposite. I'd readied myself for a phone conversation with Mr. Hyde, but Dr. Jekyll had picked up the call. September 18th, 48 days to the election. Before we left Philly the previous day, I'd made an unscheduled stop to say hi to young volunteers doing voter registration training at the city's community college. There were about 80 kids who all jumped up screaming, hooting, and whistling when I dropped in unannounced. They'd made signs for the walls. Shirley ran so Kamala can win, and vote like your life depends on it. I told them we're all born potential leaders and that it inspired me that they'd kicked in to that role at such an early stage of life. You're brilliant, you care, and you're impatient, I told them. I thanked them for what they'd committed to do over the next 48 days. I'd been where they were. A young advocate dedicated to change. I know there are many other things you could be doing. Don't put aside your studies and, you know, shower from time to time. Eat some vegetables. They laughed in recognition. Back in D.C., I met with interns from the Congressional Hispanic Caucus Institute and had a call with the young leaders tasked with getting out the youth vote. I told each group they made me optimistic for the future of our country and that I knew what the stakes were for them. They were the first generation to grow up with our planet already in climate crisis. The first generation who went through school doing lockdown drills. I promised them I would take bold action so that those here and yet to come have a livable planet and safe streets and schools. I advised the volunteers to use their interactions with potential voters as a way of building community, reminding young voters that they do have power. Your vote is your voice is your power, and we won't let anyone take our power from us, I told them. Of course, in these meetings, in person and on Zoom, I was talking to the most politically engaged young people. It was devastating to learn after the election that I lost some ground with voters under 30, especially young men. Pundits speak about the, quote, bro vote, the, quote, frat boy flank. I don't think of them in those reductive terms. Instead, I think about these young voters coming of age during COVID, unnaturally isolated, their lives lonely when they should have been at their most social. At the very moment their world should have been widening, it had contracted. For some, the voices that filled the void belonged to Andrew Tate, Myron Gaines, and others who grab attention with get-rich or fitness content, then deliver arguments that feminism is damaging to masculinity, and women, quote, need to know their place. Polling revealed that many of these young voters didn't feel they knew me. And contrary to some predictions, they did not vote primarily on reproductive rights or Gaza or climate change. They voted on their perceived economic interests. In a post-election study conducted by Tufts University, 40% put the economy and jobs as their top issue. The next priority was abortion, 13%, climate change was a top issue for 8%, foreign policy, including Gaza, 4%. My policies, which would have helped young voters with protection for renters, a home down payment, or student debt relief, or elevating the opportunities of non-college graduates, or increasing access to capital, had not cut through the false notion that Trump was some kind of economic savant who would somehow be better for their personal financial position. In 107 days, I didn't have enough time to show how much more I would do to help them than he ever would. And that makes me immensely sad. Every night of those 107 days, my last prayer before sleep was to ask God, have I done everything I could do today? I don't know if there was more that I could have done to help those young people know me better, to give me their vote. I do know that I tried. September 19th, 47 days to the election. If there was one event that best captured the diversity of the coalition that had come together to support me, it was the Unite for America town hall hosted by Oprah Winfrey in Farmington Hills, Michigan. Before the town hall, I met with two families who would speak at the event. 15-year-old Natalie Griffith had been shot twice at Appalachie High School. She was still wearing bandages on her arm and shoulder. Amber Thurman, 28, died of septic shock after doctors delayed her care for 20 hours because of Georgia's abortion ban. Her mother and sister had come to tell the story. I had been scheduled to have 15 minutes with each family. That may be a lot of time in a presidential candidate's schedule, but it is far from enough time for the conversations these families deserved. I needed to hear their stories in their own words, to look at Amber's funeral service program absorbing the pain and trauma they had endured. Was there any way I could help to get them access to the resources they still needed? I didn't want them to feel that they were just case studies to be wheeled on stage to make a political point. They were showing tremendous courage in sharing their stories, selflessly trying to help others. It was painful and draining to learn what they'd been through, and I was determined to take as much time as I could, even if it messed with the schedule. Oprah was running this town hall, and the mood in the auditorium was high-spirited. As I waited in the wings, listening to the Queen of Charisma excite the crowd, I took a moment to recenter myself. There were just 400 people in the hall, but more than 200,000 on the Zoom screens that rose in tiers, like stadium seating on the walls on either side of us. There were some famous faces on those screens, supporters such as Meryl Streep, Ben Stiller, Jennifer Lopez, and Chris Rock, who joked he'd been a longtime fan of mine. I remember writing her a check when she was like district attorney for something. Maybe it was to get out of a parking ticket, he said. Now, he said, he wanted to bring his daughters to the White House to meet this black woman president. But the power of the event wasn't so much the celebrities as the hundreds of thousands of other faces not well known from every possible demographic that could vote. In the front row was the driving force behind it, Jotaika Eady. She had been sitting on her parents' porch in South Carolina when she got a text saying that Joe Biden had dropped out and endorsed me. Not 3 hours later, she'd rallied 44,000 black women to support me on a call that broke Zoom, which couldn't handle any more participants. The night raised $1.5 million. She organized her group, Win With Black Women, in 2020 because of anger over how the black women candidates in the running to be Biden's vice president were being portrayed in the media. All the familiar tropes. The Jezebel, who slept her way to the top, the Sapphire, who'd emasculated and disparaged black men, had been dusted off to smear us. And Jotaika, an activist and founder of a successful Silicon Valley consultancy, decided to mobilize black women to fight back and rally behind black women candidates. After that first Zoom call, others contacted Jotaika to ask how to do the same thing. From her mentoring came Win With Black Men, White Dudes for Harris, White Women Answer the Call, Comics for Kamala, Deadheads for Kamala, Cat Ladies for Kamala, Cooking for Kamala, Swifties for Kamala, Jewish Women for Kamala Harris, Caregivers for Harris, Republicans for Harris, and dozens more. I look around at these screens. I look at who's in the room, and this is America, I said. This movement is about reminding each other that we have so much more in common than what separates us. Seeing in the face of a stranger, a neighbor. September 23rd, 43 days to the election. There are red lines, and there are shades of gray. Many of our national security relationships exist in complicated tones. Very few are black and white. We pursue common interests in some areas while managing major conflicting views in others. Where it is possible, without compromising our principles, we strive for constructive engagement. In September, as international heads of state converged on New York City for the UN General Assembly, I would generally schedule back-to-back meetings with world leaders, seizing the opportunity to renew ties and to talk frankly face to face. But in the midst of the campaign, I couldn't do that. I scheduled just one meeting with President Mohammed bin Zayed Al Nahyan, or MBZ as he is known, ruler of the United Arab Emirates. The UAE is a key player in its roiling region. We have numerous economic and military ties, as well as areas of disagreement. In May of 2022, I led the U.S. delegation, which included Tony Blinken, to the UAE capital, Abu Dhabi, to to pay respects to the late ruler, Sheikh Khalifa, and to meet with his successor. It was a 20-hour flight for 3 hours on the ground, which testifies to the significance the United States places on this relationship. I had met with MBZ since then at the UN Climate Conference in Dubai. This time, I would welcome him to my West Wing office, the first visit to the White House by a sitting UAE president. MBZ realizes the importance of the relationship and works on it. He also understands his power and is no supplicant. He was born knowing he would very likely rule, and he now knows he will likely rule until he dies. In that time, he is undoubtedly aware that he will cycle through many elected leaders in the United States, just like his father and his brother, who preceded him as leaders. In meetings like this, it is important to understand how the relationship has waxed and waned. I was aware that MBZ was not pleased when the Obama administration negotiated secretly with Iran in the neighboring state of Oman without informing him. I was also aware that despite the outward congeniality during Trump's first term, there had been concerns about the shallowness of Trump's grasp on the region's history and complexity. The UAE is a major purchaser of advanced American weapons and largely thanks to MBZ, has one of the most effective militaries in the region. He was 29 years old when Iraq invaded Kuwait, and he shared his father's determination that such a thing would never happen to the UAE. The Emirates now has compulsory military service and highly trained special forces. In many ways, he is a visionary, encouraging an outward-looking culture tolerant of non-Islamic religions, investing in education, supporting women's participation in the workforce and the military. He has streamlined his state's bureaucracy and diversified the economy away from oil, determined to make it a leader in artificial intelligence. He has also created a surveillance state with zero tolerance for any hint of radical Islamism, which he sees as an existential threat. He has imprisoned his critics and stoked fighting in Yemen, Sudan, and Libya, with dire humanitarian consequences. I have found him thoughtful, shrewd, and whether his priorities are aligned or in conflict with ours, I believe he is driven by conviction. He sees Hamas as an example of the radical Islamic movements that pose a threat to the stability of the Gulf regimes. He understands Israel's desire to crush it. But he also wants an end to the Gaza war and innocent civilian suffering, and he wants to see a path toward a Palestinian state. Emirati investment will be critical in rebuilding Gaza, but he has made it clear that there will be no funding until there is a Palestinian state on the horizon. The thaw in his country's relations with Israel would not continue while the humanitarian catastrophe continued to unfold. Sudan, meanwhile, has taken the UAE to the International Court of Justice, claiming the UAE has sent advanced weapons to the Rapid Support Forces, a paramilitary group accused of raping and slaughtering civilians. Our UN ambassador, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, had witnessed firsthand the civilian catastrophe it caused and had called on the UAE to support peace talks. With my national security advisor, Phil Gordon, beside me, we discussed these two conflicts and what steps MBZ might be willing to take to de-escalate in Sudan and support humanitarian relief in Gaza. In both conflicts, I stressed that our priority was to get the warring parties to the table and allow unfettered humanitarian access. MBZ had brought his brother, Sheikh Tanun, who is leading the UAE's AI superpower campaign and is responsible for billions in investment. He has lived and breathed AI since discovering Google's AI chess program in 2017. I expressed my concern that AI should be cultivated and used in the public interest, and that we need to establish international rules and norms for that. The Sheikh's first priority was investing in innovation and securing the UAE's primacy as the tech leader in the Gulf. He was, at least, receptive to the conversation. September 24th, 42 days to the election. It was a conversation of a very different kind the next day, with Steven Jackson and Matt Barnes, two retired NBA stars. Steven and Matt reach a large audience of sports fans with their outspoken take on issues on and off the basketball court in their podcast, All the Smoke. It's not a place you expect to find politicians, which is why I was eager to go there. You have to go where the voters are. You can't expect them to come to you. We sat down in front of the fireplace at the vice president's residence and got to reminiscing about the season they'd spent together playing ball for my favorite team, the Golden State Warriors. It was the We Believe season of 2006-2007. I was San Francisco DA, and I was stuck in traffic on the way to the stadium. Thinking I was going to miss the game, I jumped from the car, causing consternation to my protection detail, and jumped on BART along with people from all around the Bay Area, from every walk of life. Steven, or Stack as he is known, had a tough start in Port Arthur, Texas, where his older brother died of head injuries after a beating. Stack had carried a weight from that tragedy, always wishing he'd been by his brother's side to defend him in that fatal fight. I recognized that protective impulse. It was so like the one that had always motivated me. For Stack, it was what made him a fantastic teammate, but it also got him into trouble as a young player for Indiana, when he leapt into the stands to back up another player in what turned into an ugly brawl with fans. Don Nelson, then the Warriors coach, had been the one who embraced him after that mess, without judgment, and helped him realize his potential. Right from the start, our conversation was intimate and heartfelt, picking up shared threads of our experiences. We talked about things we had in common, like being step-parents, and our mutual concerns about mental health and childhood trauma. Matt, who has an Italian mom and a black dad, told of an incident in high school when someone called his little sister names, and he defended her. In response, the KKK vandalized his school. "And I knew at that point," he said, "although I was very proud to be Italian and black, that the world looked at me as a black man." He spoke about his relationship with his stepsons, telling them, "I'm just an extra layer of support and protection. I'm not there to replace your dad." It was very much how I felt in my relationship with Ella and Cole. I said that the particular blessing I had was a close and respectful relationship with Kirsten, their mother. Matt made a face and indicated he had more work to do there. "You're giving me a hot flash," he said. "You have to work at it," I told him. I'd learned that modeling healthy emotional relationships for our kids is just as important as anything else we do for them, like helping with homework or teaching them to drive. It's such a big piece of business that we don't think about nearly enough. We will be teaching them, one way or another, in what they observe of the emotional relationships we have. As the three of us shared anecdotes from our lives, there was so much warmth and recognition. There was light banter in the conversation, the kind only possible between people who see each other, know each other, and can speak in a kind of shorthand. But we finished on a serious note. Stack had been friends with fellow Texan George Floyd for years, ever since a mutual friend had pointed out how alike they looked. When they met in person, the first question each asked the other was, "Who's your daddy?" The only difference between them, Stack said, was that he had opportunities that George Floyd just did not get. I said it was a failure of the system to point to the exceptions like Stack, who managed to transcend their experiences, as if that was an indication that there was some kind of level playing field. What about the kid who doesn't have a remarkable talent? That is not a system that is going to be productive for the greatest number of people. The system is not working if only the exceptional people are able to succeed. The murder of Floyd had turned Stack into an activist. He became a powerful voice seeking justice, but also for seeking it by peaceful means. When Minneapolis burned, he called for restraint. Rioting, he said, was not the answer. "I've never stood for that, and Floyd didn't stand for that," he said. George Floyd's daughter is only 11 years old. Stack has become close to her and spoke movingly of how they held each other up after her father's murder. "A lot of days when I didn't know what I was doing, just hearing her call me uncle, and, you know, just telling me she loved me, those days picked me up a lot. She is definitely a special child." As we wound up the recording and took off our mics, Matt, 6'7", and Stack, 6'8", unfolded their lanky frames from the formal chairs of the sitting room. As I stood between them for our photograph, I knew this disparity in our heights would be noticeable, to say the least. But I was proud to stand with two giants of the court who were unafraid to speak openly of hurt and trauma, healing and love. September 25th, 41 days to the election. With Mark Cuban in the audience, I addressed the Economic Club of Pittsburgh. Mark had been a big supporter throughout the campaign, doing numerous events in which he picked apart the dangerous flaws in Trump's tariff policy and warned of its consequences to both businesses and consumers. He had credibility and was able to reach a variety of important constituencies: big business, small business, sports fans, and people who just liked his no-nonsense personality on Shark Tank. At the end of long days, I loved to watch reruns of Shark Tank, and my habit was to then Google and see how years later the various businesses that had won investment were doing. I needed voters to know the specifics of how I intended to put more money in their pockets today and to improve their prospects in the future. I started by acknowledging that the cost of living was still way too high. "You know it, and I know it," I told them. My proposal was for a new tax credit for investment and job creation in key industries like steel, biotech, AI, semiconductors, aerospace, autos, and farming. I talked about the importance of retooling existing factories, the credits that would encourage local hiring, and protecting the right to organize. I pledged to double the number of apprenticeships during my first term and increase skills-based hiring. As president, I said I could eliminate the degree requirements for 500,000 federal jobs in favor of skills-based hiring and apprenticeships, and that I would then challenge the private sector to do the same. We could grow the nation's cybersecurity workforce in this way and provide a model that private enterprise could emulate. My talk was of things I knew I could actually do as president and things that I knew would work. I warned that Trump's tariffs would raise costs and risk recession. I was confident about my analysis because I had a powerful team of economic advisors with different expertise. Brian Nelson had been my special assistant attorney general in California and understood my policy perspective. Brian Deese was a former director of the National Economic Council and had worked in the White House on the clean energy transition. Deanne Millison handled outreach to CEOs, small business, and private sector engagement in Africa and Central America for me at the White House. But as much as I hammered my economic message, it didn't seem to be penetrating fast enough. Over the course of the campaign, my polling on the economy went up 15 to 20 points in battleground states, amplified by leaders like Mark and my Divine Nine brother, Jimmy McMichael, head of Cap Alpha Psi, along with the leadership of Iota Phi Theta. These fraternities are deeply committed to mentorship and economic empowerment with powerful reach into the Black community. In a longer campaign, I might have had time to better bring the message home. Later, I'd have a telling exchange with Charlemagne the God, the host of the popular radio show, The Breakfast Club. I've been on his show many times, Charlemagne is a savvy interviewer with a missionary zeal for reaching Black men and a particular commitment to mental health issues. His show has a radio audience of 8 million monthly. When I appeared on his show, he lit right into me. "You come off as very scripted. You stick to your talking points." "That would be called discipline," I retorted. When he pressed me, I explained that I needed to repeat my messages so that everyone could get to know what I stand for. It's not especially fun to give the same speech 3 times a day in 3 different cities 4 or 5 times a week, but it's necessary. Trump stood up there and spouted unfiltered nonsense about Hannibal Lecter and electric sharks. He called it, quote, "the weave." I call it nonsense. The double standard on our style of presentation was galling. If I hesitated or backtracked mid-sentence to try to clarify or better express a thought, it was, quote, "word salad." Meanwhile, Trump could describe Hurricane Florence as, quote, "one of the wettest we've ever seen from the standpoint of water," unquote. September 26th, 40 days to the election. A storm was heading toward Florida. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky was due for a meeting at my ceremonial office. And, as leader of the first White House Office of Gun Violence Prevention, I was scheduled to speak at the signing of an executive order creating a task force to combat ghost guns and improve safety drills in schools. The low-pressure system that would become Hurricane Helene had begun forming on September 22nd in the Caribbean and rapidly intensified as it moved across the warm waters of the Gulf of Mexico. It would reach Category 4 intensity before the end of the day and slam into the Florida coast before midnight, carving a path of awful destruction through 5 states. But all I could do that day was to urge people to heed warnings and follow the advice of their local officials. The meeting with Zelensky would be my 7th. I'd first met him at the Munich Security Conference in February 2022. It was a tough meeting. I had to convince him of something he was reluctant to hear, that a Russian invasion was just days or maybe even hours away. In my speech to the summit, I'd declared, quote, "the foundation of European security is under direct threat in Ukraine." I called out Putin's playbook, his spreading of lies, disinformation, propaganda. After that speech in a private room across the street from the conference venue, I sat down with Zelensky and laid out our intelligence, which differed from what the Ukrainians had gathered. I had to tell him bluntly that his numbers were wrong and invasion was imminent. Zelensky still believed that Putin was merely flexing and wouldn't mount a full-scale war against his country. It was my job to get him to face the urgent reality. "What would you have me do?" he finally asked. "Get your people ready," I replied. And he did. Few of us know who we will be in a time of crisis until we are tested. I often think of the window cleaner trapped in a stalled elevator the day the planes hit the World Trade Center. Refusing to give up, he used the sharp edge of his squeegee to gouge through the wall and led everyone in that elevator to safety. Did he know when he set out for work on that ordinary day that he would be the hero who saved lives? Zelensky, who had been a comedian, has proved himself an exceptional wartime leader. He has stepped up to a task he never expected, inspiring his people with his personal courage, drawing support from the whole world, defending the sovereignty and territorial integrity of his country against the might of Russia. Now, after almost 1,000 days of conflict, we met in the midst of the bloodshed and destruction that his people were suffering to discuss how the United States could best continue to support Ukraine's resistance. Our conversation was candid, we had developed a relationship of trust. It was the kind of day that reminded me why I was a public servant. What I said and did that day would have an impact on people affected by a natural disaster, a war, and the ongoing scourge of gun violence. The executive order came in the wake of another dispiriting Supreme Court decision, striking down the federal ban on bump stocks. Sometimes I felt that improving our gun laws was a frustrating game of whack-a-mole. No sooner did we pass a law than the gun lobby filed suit and the conservative court overturned it. Meanwhile, the lawless found ways to get around the scant regulations still in place. And so we live with the fact that 1 in 5 Americans has a relative who was killed by gun violence. We gathered in the East Room of the White House. Sari Kaufman, who survived the 2018 mass shooting at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida, introduced me. Many other survivors and activists filled the room. The new executive order was timed to mark the first anniversary of the White House Office of Gun Violence Prevention. It was aimed at deadly machine gun conversion devices, or MCDs, and 3D printed ghost guns. Even though these devices are illegal, police had seen a staggering 570% rise in MCD seizures. The devices are cheap, easy to make, and deadly. One type, a quote, Glock switch, converts the pistol into a weapon capable of firing up to 1,200 rounds a minute. The new task force would come up with better ways to tackle the manufacture and distribution of these devices. As Joe signed the executive order, he turned and handed me the pen, saying, "Keep it going, boss." September 27th, 39 days to the election. As rain lashed the tarmac at Joint Base Andrews, a wet and miserable press pool huddled under the wing of Air Force Two, trying not to get soaked. Washington, D.C. was experiencing the edge of Hurricane Helene. Mark Kelly and I were headed to a drier climate in his home state of Arizona, where we would visit the border. Even though the devastation of the hurricane was beginning to be clear, I knew I wouldn't be able to visit the affected areas for several days. It was important to stay out of the way of the emergency efforts and not add to their logistical challenges. Search and rescue was underway, and first responders needed to focus all of their efforts on relief and recovery without diverting their resources. On my way to the border, I would get briefings from the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA. I knew that a significant amount of my time would be dedicated to supporting the relief effort and ensuring that the people on the ground got everything they needed and deserved. Although some of the most conservative Republicans had helped draft a bipartisan bill with the toughest set of border reforms in decades, Trump had intervened to kill it, calling it, quote, a waste of paper. So instead of a bipartisan agreement, which is so badly needed to properly address the border crisis, after the lifting of Title 42, which curbed migration during the pandemic, we'd used executive action that had cut unlawful border crossings by half to the lowest level in 4 years. We'd increased the number of border agents and provided fentanyl scanners, which had led to more fentanyl seizures in the past 2 years than the previous 5. Even so, Trump was slaying us in polls on this issue. He preferred to run on the problem, spouting incendiary language about a, quote, invasion by criminals and violent gangs, rather than fix the problem. Never mind that immigrants are less likely to commit violent and property crime than American-born individuals, or that cities with more immigrants have similar or lower rates of violent and property crimes than areas with fewer. Those statistics don't register like powerful visuals of migrant caravans or large groups of desperate people wading across the Rio Grande, especially when the visuals are accompanied by hysterical commentary by the likes of Fox News hosts designed to whip up anxiety and anger. There is a bleak and tragic history in this country of demonizing immigrants. The Jewish refugees who were denied entry when fleeing annihilation in Nazi Germany. The Chinese, Italians, and Irish who were hated, vilified, and slandered in almost the same terms as the right uses about today's migrants. The Japanese who were interned, denied freedom and due process solely on the basis of their race. Immigration had surged, and to some it felt like an invasion. We couldn't gaslight the people who felt that way by denying the problem. We did not succeed in making a passionate case for a complete immigration overhaul that combined securing the border with a better legal mechanism for the people who arrive here with a dream of success and contribution. People who are no different from the parents, grandparents, or great-grandparents many of us love and revere who made a similar journey in search of an American dream. I did not have time in 107 days to undo 10 years of Trump's demonization of immigrants. All I could do was show that we had taken measures that were working and that I took the issue seriously and would continue to press for the comprehensive reforms we needed. The challenge was to make this visit more than a photo op. Mark and I flew to Tucson and helicoptered to Douglas in bright red Cochise County. The town of 16,000 people has close ties with its neighbor city in Mexico, Agua Prieta, as do many border towns, and the challenge is to facilitate efficient legal crossings, which are helpful for commerce while cracking down on illegal ones. It was a rough ride in the Osprey chopper, the rising desert air tossing us around as if we were in a spin dryer. The temperature was also like a dryer, 106 degrees. At the busy port of entry, I listened as the border agents spoke of their challenges, and I thanked them for doing a tough job, covering about 260 miles of border. Then we took a walk along a line of fence built during the Obama administration. Trump had once staged a photo op touting his, quote, big beautiful wall, but he'd done it in front of a section that Obama built. Of the many things I was prepared to say at the debate, this was one observation I regretted not delivering. Trump had 4 years to increase the number of border agents to boost the number of border judges. He did neither. All he did was fan flames of hate and division, highlighting rare, tragic cases of violent crime while smearing the overwhelming majority of hardworking immigrants. I was the one who'd walked through tunnels that traffickers used to smuggle contraband and broken up a heroin trafficking ring connected to Mexican cartels. I'd done the hard work to bring criminals to justice and relief to the families of their victims. September 28th, 38 days to the election. I was in San Francisco for a campaign fundraiser when I started to learn about the misinformation and conspiracy theories being spread about hurricane relief. It was a demonstration in real time of the dangers posed to real people by an unmoderated social media swamp. Someone with the username MattWallace888, who had more than 2 million followers, wrote that, quote, elites had engaged in, quote, weather modification to target counties that voted for Trump in the last election. I thought the idea was too crazy, even for the most gullible, but his tweet received more than 11 million views. In a second post, he overlaid the storm's path on a map of the 2020 election results, attempting to, quote, prove his crazy theory. The conspiracy took off on X and then TikTok, with videos there viewed more than a million times. That night, we flew to Los Angeles, where I had an event the following day. It was the only night I would sleep in my own home, in my own bed, during the campaign. Being home was not necessarily a good thing. I knew as I opened my front door that everything would have deteriorated after such a long absence. I know this sounds crazy, but houses resent being unlived in, or mine seems to. Every time I come back from a significant time away, something goes wrong. If it's hot, the AC won't work. If it's cold, there will be no heat. One time, I tried to use the oven and it literally exploded. The garden will look neglected, my herb garden yellowed, and I knew arriving at 6:23 p.m. and leaving the next day with a full binder of tasks and schedule of calls to accomplish, I wouldn't be there long enough to do anything about it. I would keep my road warrior mentality. I would take a bath, get a good night's sleep, and pretend my own home was a hotel. September 29th, 37 days to the election. Hair color, manicure, call and call and call. 2:01 p.m., VP rolling. Fundraiser in Los Angeles. Rally in Las Vegas. 9:23 p.m., lid. September 30th, 36 days to the election. I canceled my campaign swing through Nevada and rescheduled media interviews, including with Alex Cooper of the podcast Call Her Daddy. I needed to head back to FEMA headquarters in Washington, D.C. I had a lot of experience at this. As a senator, I'd been on the committee that oversees FEMA, and I had an excellent relationship of trust with the agency's leadership. During the first Trump administration, I'd seen how relief efforts had been shaped by a petty partisan agenda, and I was determined not to let anything like that happen on my watch. And even as I was taking valuable time from my campaign to fulfill my responsibilities as vice president, Trump posted on his social media site that Joe and I were, quote, going out of our way to not help people in Republican areas hit by Hurricane Helene. In a second post, he said we had, quote, left Americans to drown in North Carolina, Georgia, Tennessee, Alabama, and elsewhere in the South. He claimed that Georgia's Republican governor, Brian Kemp, had a, quote, hard time reaching Biden to discuss disaster relief, and that the president had been, quote, very non-responsive. All of it was, of course, lies. Kemp quickly rebutted Trump's claim, saying the president had called him and asked simply, what do you need? More than 230 people had died in the worst hurricane since Katrina. But instead of consoling and helping, Trump was stoking rage with falsehoods and making it harder for FEMA workers to do their jobs. Some FEMA workers had guns pulled on them. At his rallies, he claimed that our administration had, quote, spent all of the disaster relief money, quote, for housing illegal immigrants. As he knew or should have known, the much smaller fund for migrant shelter is totally different from FEMA's disaster relief fund. It was Trump who, when president, took money from the disaster fund and directed it toward immigration enforcement. He tried to connect his bogus claims to his assertions about non-citizens voting. He said we'd given the FEMA money, quote, to their illegal immigrants that they want to have vote for them this season. Elon Musk would pick up the lies and amplify them in his own post. Quote, yes, they are literally using your tax dollars to import voters and disenfranchise you. Marjorie Taylor Greene would pile on, quote, yes, they can control the weather. On the plane, I called and spoke with Governor Roy Cooper in North Carolina, Brian Kemp in Georgia, and mayors in the worst-hit communities in all the affected states. I tried repeatedly to reach Ron DeSantis, who remained unavailable. The list of what we were doing to help was extensive. FEMA trucks of food and water were arriving. 24 search and rescue task forces had been deployed and already rescued and supported more than 1,400 people. The Coast Guard, the Army Corps of Engineers, the Environmental Protection Agency, the Department of Agriculture, the Small Business Administration, and the Department of Energy had all deployed personnel. It was, in fact, a massive relief effort. Sadly, in the aftermath, polls in the affected communities would show that whether people felt that the federal government had done a good job split exactly on party lines. October 1st, 35 days to the election. The day leading up to Tim's debate with J.D. Vance had been filled with tension. Though I'd come back to D.C. to get briefings on the hurricane catastrophe, it was a different crisis that put me in the Situation Room that day. The Iranian response we'd been concerned about had come in the shape of about 180 ballistic missiles. Sirens howled over Israel just before 7:30 p.m. local time, 12:30 p.m. in D.C. In the Situation Room, I monitored the attack. The Defense Department later shared publicly that our destroyers in the Eastern Mediterranean were part of a coordinated response that downed most of the missiles. The limited damage and few casualties made it less likely that Netanyahu would mount a massive counterstrike and drag the region into full-blown war. There was more riding on Tim's debate than there should have been. Trump's proposal back in August to debate me two more times had been withdrawn. We wanted another debate.